Dreamers and Builders. No one knows for sure who was the first person to suggest a railroad that, by linking the East Coast with the West Coast, would shrink the continent and change the whole world. It may have been Samuel Dexter, the editor of a small Michigan newspaper called The Western Emigrant. "It is in our power," Dexter wrote in 1832, "to open an immense interior country to market, to unite our eastern and western shores firmly together." Another railroad enthusiast, Dr. Samuel Barlow, shared Dexter's vision. In an article published in a Westport, Massachusetts weekly, he envisioned a railroad over which passengers could cross the entire 3,000 miles of the United States in an unheard-of 30 days while traveling at the incredible speed of 10 miles an hour. A transcontinental railroad, Barlow declared, would be the greatest public work that mortal man has ever yet accomplished. Some 10 years later, a wealthy New York businessman named Asa Whitney, a distant relative of Eli Whitney, who had invented the cotton gin, actually petitioned Congress for the building of such a railroad. Aside from linking the nation, Whitney saw another enormous benefit that a transcontinental railroad would bring. He had made much of his fortune by selling his products to China and bringing back such wanted goods as tea, spices, and silk. But he had been forced to endure the long months it took to exchange these products between East Coast ports and Asia by ship. A railroad to West Coast ports, he declared, would make the long and often dangerous ocean voyage to Asia much shorter and much more profitable. It would, in fact, open up the lucrative China trade to all American merchants. Whitney did everything he could to convince Congress to authorize the railroad he envisioned. He even offered to build it at his own expense if he was given enough land in the West that he could then sell. Determined to prove that it could be done, he organized an expedition into the vast territory to explore the best possible route for his railroad to take. It was all in vain. Even those few congressmen who believed that it just might be possible for such a railroad to be built could not agree on supporting Whitney. Southern congressmen insisted that it take a southern route. Others said that they could not even consider such a project unless the railroad passed through their city or state. Whitney, Dexter, and Barlow were but three of at least a score of individuals who, in the 1830s and 1840s, made their feelings known about the enormous benefits a transcontinental railroad would bring to the nation. But understanding what such an iron road would do for the country was one thing. Being able to build it was quite another. The vast majority of government officials and almost all private citizens shared the same opinion. It simply couldn't be done. In response to a claim that a transcontinental railroad would create settlements, commerce, and wealth, the Cincinnati Daily Gazette declared that those making this claim might just as well be promising to unite neighboring planets in our solar system and make them better acquainted with each other. It was not difficult to understand why the newspaper's editors felt this way. The nation's existing railroad lines went no farther west than the Missouri River. The distance from that point to the Pacific was 1,800 miles. It wasn't just the staggering distance, though. Every railroad that had ever been built had been constructed to connect one city or town to another inhabited area. But between the Missouri River and the Pacific Ocean, except for significant Native American communities and Salt Lake City, there was not a single settlement of any real size. It was, as a Boston newspaper described it, a big blank slate. A transcontinental railroad, if it could somehow be built, would be the first railroad ever constructed in advance of civilization. And that was not all. Construction crews would have to lay tracks over some of the most difficult terrain on Earth. Hundreds of miles of searing desert would have to be crossed. Even more challenging, as one early railroad historian wrote, "Any transcontinental railroad must cross two mountain chains popularly regarded as impossible barriers. Still fresh in the memory of emigrants who crawled westward were mountain trails so steep that wagons had to be lowered by rope. Moreover, little was known of the principles of traction. Only a few years earlier, even engineers generally believed that gravity would defy any attempt to drive a locomotive uphill. In order to build a railroad through these mountains, the highest bridges ever erected would have to be built. Tunnels through mountains of pure granite would have to be constructed. All this had to be accomplished without bulldozers, rock drills, or modern explosives. A transcontinental railroad would have to be built entirely by hand. There were no trees on the hundreds of miles of the American prairie to use for railroad ties. There were no factories or foundries to manufacture rails anywhere near where the tracks would be laid. The millions of railroad ties, the miles and miles of iron rails, the enormously heavy steam locomotives, and almost everything else that would be required would have to be shipped to the building sites, from the east across the Missouri River, from the west all the way around Cape Horn in South America, a 15,000-mile voyage by sea. And if this was not enough to discourage even the most ardent proponent of a railroad that would link the nation, there were other enormous challenges as well. Prominent among them was the weather that was certain to be encountered. On the plains, temperatures were known to rise to well over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Tornadoes destroyed everything in their path. In the mountains, temperatures dropped as low as 30 degrees below zero, and snow piled up as high as 60 feet. And over miles and miles of the territory that would have to be crossed was the specter of what most struck fear into the hearts of all those who dared venture into the West. Tens of thousands of Native Americans determined to keep intruders from encroaching upon land that was still their own. No wonder that when photographer and civil engineer John Plumb sent his own proposal for a transcontinental railroad to Congress, one congressman stated that Plumb's request was as far-fetched as asking the government to build a railroad to the moon. Well into the 1840s, the idea of a transcontinental railroad seemed an impossible one. Some of the nation's leading figures made a point of questioning the value of linking the heavily settled and civilized East with what they viewed as the sparsely settled, untamed West. Among them was Massachusetts's legendary Senator Daniel Webster. "What do we want with this region of savages and wild beasts, of deserts, of shifting sands and whirlwinds of dust, of cactus and prairie dogs?" Webster asked his fellow senators. "To what use could we ever put these endless mountain ranges? What could we do with the western coastline 3,000 miles away? Rockbound, cheerless, and uninviting." Strong words, but in a nation still less than 100 years old, things were changing rapidly. By 1850, California had developed to a point where it was admitted as a state. Oregon and other western territories stood poised to be admitted as well. Perhaps most important, gold had been discovered in California. Gold fever gripped the nation. Thousands of people from every part of the country, seeking to get rich, dropped whatever they were doing and headed for the gold fields. Some spent months walking all the way to California. Others went on horseback or in wagon trains. Those who could afford the high price of a ticket made the 6 to 9 month voyage by sailing vessel or steamship. Many others who had far less money boarded any type of vessel that would float. It was a phenomenon that lasted throughout the 1850s, and one that the government could not help but notice. What if there had been a cross-country railroad over which these thousands of fortune seekers could have traveled? What if such a railroad had made it possible for the government itself to take advantage of the gold, and particularly the other minerals that were being uncovered? Suddenly, the mood of the government changed. Reasons for building the railroad, including those first articulated by early visionaries like Asa Whitney, were revisited. They were perhaps expressed most clearly in a report commissioned by the California State Senate. "A railroad from some point on the Mississippi or its tributaries to some point on the Bay of San Francisco," the report stated, "is the best route that can be adopted for the purpose of securing the commerce of China or India. It would also be the means of great daily intercourse between the east and west coast of this republic. It is the duty of this legislature to encourage the speedy building of a railroad from the Atlantic to the Pacific, across the territory of the United States. In 1856, a special committee of the Congress concluded that the necessity that exists for constructing lines of railroad and telegraphic communication between the Atlantic and Pacific coasts of this continent is no longer a question for argument. It is conceded by everyone. An 1853 article in the widely read Putnam's Monthly Magazine actually foresaw the committee's findings. "A railroad from the Mississippi to California or Oregon is a foregone conclusion," the article stated. "Stupendous as the enterprise seems, rivaling in grandeur and surpassing in usefulness any work that the genius of man has hitherto undertaken, it has been decided that it must be built. Surveying parties appointed by the government to explore the routes are already on the ground." The surveyors had a most important assignment. The question of what route the railroad should take had become as vital an issue as whether the railroad should be built. In March 1853, in an attempt to answer the question, the government instructed the Secretary of War, Jefferson Davis, the man who 7 years later would become president of the Southern states in rebellion against the United States, to organize 4 separate surveying expeditions to determine which route would be the most practicable and economical to the Pacific. Each of the expeditions was a remarkable undertaking. Just one of them alone, led by Army Lieutenant Amiel Weeks Whipple, included 70 men, 250 mules, and a long train of large freight wagons. Whipple's scientific staff included not only surveyors, but also geologists, botanists, astronomers, naturalists, and artists. As one journal would later report, "Not since Napoleon had taken his company of scholars and experts into Egypt had the world seen such an assemblage of scientists and technicians marshaled under one banner." The surveying expedition's findings were published in a 12-volume set of books that contained detailed assessments of whether the land they had explored would provide a suitable path for a railroad. The books were also filled with many maps and artists' drawings and descriptions of wildlife, plants, and trees, as well as the Native American peoples they had encountered. It was a marvelous achievement, providing the nation with the greatest amount of knowledge about the geography of the West it had ever received. But as far as the government was concerned, it was also a major disappointment. For in the end, it was determined that none of the routes that had been explored was suitable for the building of the Iron Road. Ironically, the discovery of this vital route would come about not through the endeavors of hundreds of surveyors and scientists, but through the extraordinary efforts of 2 men, each very different from the other, operating half a continent apart. Among those who had read the surveyors' reports with great interest was a 28-year-old civil engineer named Theodore Judah. With the help of 100 workers, he had just supervised the construction of California's first railroad line in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada. When the 21-mile-long line was completed, Judah had gone to the president of the new line and urged him to let him extend the line much farther. But, aware of the towering Sierra Nevada that lay ahead, the president turned him down. There was no way, he told Judah, that a railroad could be built through those mountains. Theodore Dehone Judah and the American Railroad came of age together. Born in Bridgeport, Connecticut in 1826, a year before the Baltimore and Ohio, the nation's first railroad, came into being, Judah grew up in Troy, New York, where he displayed signs of genius at a remarkably early age. In 1837, when he was only 11 years old, he began taking advanced science classes at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. At the age of 13, he became a surveyor's assistant on the Schenectady and Troy Railroad. By the time he turned 25, he had learned so much about what was increasingly being regarded as the marvel of the age that he was named chief engineer for the building of the Buffalo and New York Railroad. He completed that assignment so well that he then asked to take on what many regarded as an impossible task, constructing a railroad beneath the famous Niagara Falls. Judah not only succeeded in surveying and directing the building of the Niagara Gorge Railroad, he also completed the job well ahead of schedule. It did not take long for news of Judah's accomplishments to spread. He had, in fact, become one of the nation's most acclaimed railroad engineers. Among those most impressed with what he had achieved was the president of a company formed to construct California's first railroad, a 21-mile line running from Sacramento to Folsom in the heart of the gold mining country. In search of the best man to build the road, the president offered Judah the job. Judah was thrilled. "Anna," he told his wife, "I am going to California to be the pioneer railroad engineer of the Pacific Coast." He would not only earn that distinction, he would, more than any other individual, become responsible for the birth of the Transcontinental Railroad. By 1853, when the route-seeking surveys had begun, Judah had joined the ranks of those who believed in the necessity of a transcontinental railroad. He had, in fact, become obsessed with the idea. He seemed to talk about it to anyone who would listen, so much so that, out of earshot, those around him began to refer to him as Crazy Judah. But Theodore Judah was not crazy. He was a visionary, and he was a realist as well. The United States needed a transcontinental railroad, and more than anything, he wanted to be a big part of its construction. He was well aware that, of all the incredible challenges that building a railroad from coast to coast would present, the greatest would be laying tracks through the seemingly impenetrable Sierras. And he knew that a route through those mountains had to be found. The route would have to take into account drilling and blasting tunnels through solid granite peaks, creating roadbeds around the peaks that were too long to be tunneled through, and constructing towering bridges over the Sierra's rivers and valleys. Finding a route through the Sierras was a task that would have diminished the resolve of a less determined man, but Judah was convinced that such a route could be found. He began by hiking into the Sierras, spending days, even weeks, living out in the open, enduring rain, wind, and, in the higher elevations, ice and driving snow. He mapped out a route, noting where tunnels, roadbeds, and bridges would need to be constructed. At last, he reached a point where he believed he could offer proof that a railroad through the Sierras could be built. But as he well knew, finding a route was only the first step. Nothing could happen unless the enormous amount of money needed to finance the project could be raised. Between 1856 and 1859, Judah made three trips to Washington, hoping to persuade the government to supply the funds. To support his argument, he wrote and published, at his own expense, a pamphlet titled A Practical Plan for Building the Pacific Railroad. He even set up a one-room Pacific Railroad Museum in the Capitol that included paintings of the areas over and through which his proposed railroad would travel, maps of preliminary routes he was considering, and geological specimens he had discovered. But by 1859, Congress had much more serious matters on its agenda. Despite the many different compromises that had been attempted, the northern and southern regions of the nation had grown further apart over the fact that slaveholders in the South refused to give up their slaves. Things had reached a boiling point, and the southern states were threatening to secede from the Union. After all his efforts, Judah's proposal fell on deaf ears. He did not give up. If he couldn't get funding from the government, he would try to get it from private sources. In 1860, intent on producing an even more detailed map of his proposed route through the mountains, he went back into the Sierras. He not only created a highly detailed map that he felt would attract investors, but he also solved what he had previously considered to be the one troublesome problem in his mapping. He was not satisfied that he had found the best route for tracks to be laid through the treacherous Donner Pass. But here, fortune smiled on him. In the midst of his new mapping, he received a letter from a druggist named Daniel Strong, in which Strong offered to show him a way through the pass that would accommodate a railroad. Guiding Judah through the pass, Strong led the way to a ridge between two deep river valleys. A delighted Judah immediately realized that the ridge was wide enough for tracks to be laid upon it. Convinced that he had mapped out a practical route through what he believed would be the most difficult terrain of all in constructing a transcontinental railroad, Judah drew up a document establishing a company to build a railroad. He named it the Central Pacific Railroad Company. He had a name, but no money to back the company. In November of 1860, at a meeting of potential investors in a room above a Sacramento hardware store, four wealthy men agreed to put up the money necessary to get the Central Pacific Railroad Company started. Their names were Charles Crocker, Collis Huntington, Mark Hopkins, and Leland Stanford.